Now to East Africa. In April 1994, Rwanda experienced one of the most heinous genocides in history. During a 100-day period, an estimated 800,000 people were brutally killed, mainly ethnic Tutsis, at the hands of the radical Hutus. Carl Wilkins is the former head of the Adventist Development and Relief Agency International in Rwanda. He was the only American who chose to remain in the country to provide humanitarian aid after the genocide began. He joins me now. Carl, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks for the opportunity.
What were you doing in Rwanda at the time?
You know, initially we went there to build schools, operate health centers, and 6 months after we got in the country back in 90, this three-year war started. So our work shifted then into displaced camps.
It's almost unimaginable what it must have been like to be there during that time. You're trying to do humanitarian work, and you're seeing horrendous things. What stops a person from taking action in extreme situations like that?
You know, when the foreigners were taking off, I don't know, 5,000-7,000 of them, and I talked to them later, some of them said they just never even considered it. You know, I think a lot of times people just don't know when everybody's flowing right that you could actually turn left.
Of all the things that you saw, and I'm sure there were many, both good and bad, does anything stand out for you still? All these years later.
Oh, yeah. Some of it's still just fresh as yesterday. The people who did stay by. There was a young guy three houses down from us where had been an orphanage, and the director and his wife, they evacuated the country. And this young guy who was the night watchman became the director overnight with these 30 little kids, five and under. And Harry's courage, his diplomacy with the killers, his always ready smile, his never down day type of guy. There were just people like that that just still really light my path.
At some point, though, you did have to get away to decompress, did you not?
But yeah, I think probably for almost 10 years, I hardly talked about it.
Now, here we are 15 years later. Let's talk about the restructuring efforts that are going on in Rwanda now. Describe that.
I actually had a chance to be back there this last summer. I was just really impressed as I met with some of my old friends and some new ones. There was a gentleman and his wife who'd been hiding in one of the orphanages that I was bringing food and water to 3 months in this tiny little room, six of them. And he's now a high court judge. She's deputy director of ombudsman. And this ombudsman program is just huge as far as I'm concerned. They use a word in Kinyarwanda that means someone who comes alongside you when you're in trouble. I detected again and again in the different people I talked to this effort at transparency. I mean, you know, I was talking to someone the other day saying, we have problems with trusting our government and things like that. Well, imagine if our government had betrayed us to the level that the people of Rwanda had been betrayed. And then you try to rebuild a society where everybody was touched. And I think one of the ways they're trying to do it is through transparency. They sign contracts. Everybody who has a significant position in the government signs a contract with the president himself every year for what their plans are for that year. Are they going to, you know, another 10,000 pounds of potatoes? Or are they going to add another nurse to a dispensary? And at the end of the year, it's a time of reckoning. It's a time of bragging, or it's a time of we got to restructure, or maybe it's a time you're going to be replaced.
Talking about reconciliation, though, I understand that some of the perpetrators of the genocide are living side by side with the victims. Is that true?
Oh, it blows me away. One of my friends, who's an incredible, courageous man who lost his wife during this time, he's now started a nonprofit where they bring pregnant cows into communities that are really struggling people homes. And one of his first pictures, on one side of this pregnant cow is a lady who lost her husband. On the other side is a man who's just released from participating in the genocide. It is just unbelievable that you could not only live side by side but actually interact. And those who have been working through the process, Rwandans themselves, are working with other Rwandans to just even sit in a room. There's a really good documentary called As We Forgive that kind of gives little insights into this personal efforts at reconciliation.
A big change in Rwanda since the genocide has been the increased role of women. Women account, 70%, I understand, they account for the population, the post-genocide population. Talk about their impact.
There's huge participation that is being facilitated by the government for women. And I stop and think often about many of the leaders and, I don't know, the different prejudices, the different struggling we have with tolerance and things like that. I think they're really on the good road in terms of, you know, proactively bringing women into a more active role in Rwanda.
You know, across the continent in Liberia, women played a really big role
Huge.
In bringing peace there. Is there, there's some similarities, I would imagine, with Rwanda.
You know, I haven't heard of the organized ones like we did see there, but always, I think, they've been the backbone of the country, but always in the background, not even allowed to own property. And now with these new rights given to them, we're seeing some real progress.
So, Carl, for you, in a sense, you could say that Rwanda was ground zero, but now you have expanded beyond there to continue your works around the world. Tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, I never imagined when my wife and I made the decision that I would stay and she and the kids would evacuate. You know, I told her 2 weeks max, and this thing can't last more than that. And we know it went on for 100 days, never knowing that later I'd get the opportunity. In fact, last year I quit. I was traveling part-time to schools. Last year I quit my job, and now for the last 12 months I've been traveling full-time, high schools and universities around the country, speaking on genocide, but then also speaking on what is it to enter the world of the other. You know, the bottom line for me is genocide stems from thinking that says, my world would be better without you in it. And tragically, that kind of thinking kind of sneaks around in the back of my mind and a lot of people I know. And so, you know, we're looking at ways of not only becoming aware of what's happening in Darfur right now, but also what's happening in our own backyard and how do I view the other and who am I the other to?
I suppose that reaching young people would be the appropriate place to go to try to build a new sensibility about Africa.
I had this girl in Oakland come up to me, and she says, why are you talking to us? I look around the audience here, and the kids sitting on the side of me, the people who can make a difference are people with influence, people with money, and the people sitting by me have neither. I said, it is so much more than you think in terms of the influence you have and the power you have, the sense of passion you have. You know, they haven't settled yet often in high school and stuff. We get older, and we seem to just settle and say, well, that's the way it is, and the edge seems to be taken off. But there at high school and at colleges, universities, they haven't settled for less, and it is. It's inspiring for me as I see the activism that's happening.
Now, does it happen within your own family? I don't know the ages of your children, but I wonder if your passion has been passed down to them.
You know, our three children are 25, 22, and 20, and they're not on the activist list on their campus, but I'm really proud of the way they reach out to people, I guess you could say, on the periphery. That makes me really proud, and I think that's what we need to understand, is that all of us are called to different roles in the way we build community, but the question is, you know, are we really interested in building community, because community doesn't just happen.
I suppose that would be why you had the name World Outside My Shoes as the one to describe what the work is that you're doing.
Yeah.
I appreciate it, Carl. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Hey, thanks for the chance.
Carl Wilkins is co-founder and president of World Outside My Shoes, a nonprofit educational and professional development organization. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C.